And I wanted to talk a little bit about the text for this class, one of the texts, which is Healing Anger by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We had a few copies in the bookstore. Those sold out last week. They have been reordered. Unfortunately, they're on back order. And I know this book distributor is very good about getting them to us as soon as they get them into their inventory. But I don't know when they're going to get them. I checked the libraries around. There's one copy in the Wake County Libraries, and one of our students has checked that out. There's one copy in the Durham Library, and that's lost. And there's one copy in the Chapel Hill Library, which I didn't make it. Which there's one copy available as of last week in the Chapel Hill Library. It's available on Amazon.com, and it's available from the publisher, Snow Lion. So I'll let Robbie decide how urgent it is that all our students get that text.
Well, we'll reevaluate next week. It's not that long. And it's not really core material for this course. It's kind of parallel material. Any other announcements, Joanna?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Let me see again the hands of who wasn't here last week. Okay. That's fine. Last week was introductory. So this, my name's Robbie Watkins. I'm leading this module of the two-year series Discovering Buddhism. And we have six Monday nights in this module all about karma. But before we get into the discussion of karma, as always, we'll start with some meditation. And before we do our meditation, we'll do some prayers with the images. I said last week that the prayers are preparing the soil in which we cast the seeds of our meditation, so the meditation will actually take root and flourish. If we don't do the prayers, it says like casting the seed of our meditation on barren soil. So the daily prayers are on page 34. And we'll start with Taking Refuge and Bodhicitta, which we'll read together three times in English. The Four Immeasurables, the Seven-Limb Prayer, and we'll do the short mandala offering, also in English, with the little mantra at the end. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulate since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. These remain until the end of cyclic existence, and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. Okay, since some people here may not be familiar with it, I'm just going to say a little bit about the mandala offering at the end. I think the other prayers are somewhat self-explanatory. Maybe not, but the mandala is probably the most obscure for new people. Anybody know what a mandala is? Can somebody define a mandala? Anybody want to take a stab at it? Yeah. It is, yeah. Well, that's what this mandala is, but there are lots of different mandalas. It's a perfect world, basically, a perfect environment. When you meditate on some of these tankas, these meditational deities, each one has their own mandala, which is somewhat different. And if you go off and do a meditation retreat, you imagine that you are in the center of a mandala, a perfect world. And everything around you is part of that perfect world. So in this, we're imagining the world and this ground, which is the earth, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, which is the center of this earth in the Buddhist cosmology, as you said, the four continents, the sun and moon. I imagine it as a Buddha field, which means a perfect environment. And I offer it to all living beings. Okay, so I'm imagining this, and I'm generously offering this up to all living beings. So that's what the point of the mandala is. And then it's traditional, though you don't have to do it, to accompany it with this hand mudra, the mudra of the various hand gestures. You see the deities have different mudras. There's the hand-touching mudra, and this mudra, and the teaching mudra, and all this stuff. So this is the mudra for the mandala offering. I think it'd be good if everybody who wants to become familiar with it. It's incredibly awkward if you're not familiar. Joanna, maybe you could walk around and help people, okay? The point is your two ring fingers are touching, and Susie can help also. Your two ring fingers are touching and pointing upwards. Your fifth fingers are crossed and pulled down with your thumbs. And you pull them down. And your middle fingers are crossed, and you hook your index fingers over them and pull them down. Yeah, people who are familiar with it can walk around and help, yeah. 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 Okay, got it. Let's see what you got there. Yeah, let's see. Ring fingers together. Yeah, and then these, you cross there. And then you cross those. And that loops over there. Yeah, pull those down. I'm not going to break your finger, am I? Yeah. Now curl those down with your index. Yeah, that's it. Okay. And put your thumbs on top of your, to pull your little fingers down. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you're getting it. Okay. And you kind of pull down with everything. Yeah. Okay. Everybody getting it? You got it? Yeah, okay, the only thing left is you cross your fifth fingers, your pinkies, and your thumb, you put your thumbs on your fifth fingers. Yeah, uh-huh. And then you take your index fingers and curl over your, yeah, let's see, this over like that. And pull it down. Yeah. Let's see, these two go up. Those cross. And your thumbs just go on top of the fifth fingers. Yeah, right there. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just put the thumbs on top. I don't pull them down, but yeah. And then, yeah, that's fine, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you cannot share this with anyone on pain of death. Okay, this is a secret. But anyway, it's very awkward first, but the two ring fingers in the center pointing up represent Mount Meru, the center of the universe. And then you have the four continents, okay? The four corners of it are the four continents. So you're imagining the whole world. And you hold it up like this, like you're giving it out. And so it's actually more powerful instead of just your little fingers that you're offering, that you imagine everything that's wonderful in the world. Visually imagine it and imagine that you're offering all of that. And then as we say this last mantra, and I can't really translate this. Does anybody know what it means? Idam Guru Ratna Mandalaka. But it basically involves I offer to my teacher and all sentient beings. You dissolve it, okay, comes in like this, and you go back like this. And that means you're just acknowledging that it's empty, lacking of inherent existence. It's dependent on the mind. Now, if you're at lots of times when we do pujas or other things, you'll see people with what's called a mandala set, which is the same idea, but it's a series of seven rings that they pile up, and then they sprinkle all sorts of semi-precious stones and glittery things and things that they've accumulated. And if you ever see Venerable Rabina's mantra, it weighs about 60 pounds, you know. And she won't go anywhere without it. It goes everywhere with her. But again, the whole point is to practice generosity, that I'm offering everything I can think of to all sentient beings. Any questions or comments about that? Yeah, Susie. If you've got a mala, then you can drape it over the top and offer that. Yeah, a rosary. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just over your fingers there. There's no official way of doing it. Yeah. Okay, and then you dissolve it in and back to your prayer. So that's the mandala offering. I'm sure some people have seen it and wondered, what in the world is that? But that's called a mudra, M-U-D-R-A, a hand gesture that has some meaning. And then if you go to some of the pujas or prayer services, there are all sorts of mudras that get very complicated, and Geshe Sampo is wonderful at doing those, and he occasionally will teach a class on the mudras, because we're there kind of looking very awkward and comical when we try to do them, but they can be quite graceful and beautiful when Geshe Sampo or Lama Zopa does them. Okay, so let's start off with some meditation now that we've prepared the soil, prepared our mind. So as always, we begin by checking our posture. We're sitting a little bit straighter than we normally sit. Not rigid, but a little bit straighter. Our head is straight on our shoulders, maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, but definitely not chin on chest. Eyes either slightly open or just lightly closed, but not clenched shut. Mouth is lightly closed. Again, the jaw is not clenched. The tongue is on the gums above the upper teeth. Our shoulders are down, not up around our ears, but down and a little bit back, so our chest is opened up. Our upper arms are away from the sides of our body. And our hands can either be one hand on each knee or right hand on left with our thumbs touching. If we're on a cushion, we're towards the front of the cushion. Our legs are in a position that we find comfortable. Any version of crossing our legs is fine. If we're sitting in a chair, we're not leaning back, but we're a little bit straight, our feet flat on the floor. If we want to put a cushion under our feet while we're sitting in the chair, that's fine. And the point of the posture is to open up the energy channels that travel from the top of our head, in front of our spine, down to the genitalia. We can't find them when we dissect the body, but there are various channels there, three main ones, one right in front of the spine and one to either side. It's said that the winds, the energy winds, move in and out through these channels. So we want them nice and open, not closed and blocked. And the posture should be one of stability. We feel like we're planted, really, that we could just sit here and not move. Okay, and that may not be realistic right now, but again, the point of the posture is not to torture yourself or to try and overcome physical pain. The point is a posture that's stable, self-perpetuating, and non-distracting. So just do a scan from the top of your head and see if you find any areas of tension or discomfort, and address those now before we begin the actual meditation. And having established the posture, we'll take three deep breaths from the abdomen, with the stomach expanding on the in-breath and coming back towards our spine on the out-breath. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. It's not something we need to think about. It just happens naturally. And as always, we begin our meditation by setting our motivation. And whatever motivation has brought us here tonight is perfectly fine. If we're just here out of curiosity, that's great. If we're here for just a little peace and quiet, that's fine. If we just want to calm our minds so we're a little bit more relaxed as we go about our week, that's wonderful. But the most powerful motivation, the one that gives the most force to our meditation, is what's referred to as the bodhicitta motivation. The thought that everything I do, including this meditation, is done so that I can be of greater benefit to all sentient beings. Just driving here to Kadampa Center tonight and spending a little bit of time working with my mind, I'm doing that for the benefit of all beings. My family, my friends, my co-workers, people I don't know, people I don't even like. This is freely and generously done for the benefit of all of them, with myself included in that, all sentient beings. And that's not the way we think naturally. We have to kind of force our mind to think along those lines. But let's just see if we can bring that motivation to mind for the next minute. And having set our motivation, we now begin our meditation. As always, there's a chosen object. For this meditation, the object is the breath, the movement of the breath in and out through the nostrils. We place our concentration on that. We don't space out, we don't go blank, we don't go to sleep, hopefully. We just have the concentration, the mind, on the movement of breath in and out through the nostrils. Physical sensation of air moving in and out through the openings of the nostrils. We're not going to count it. We're not going to describe it to ourselves. We're not going to think about it. The mind will directly perceive the breath. That's all. And every time the mind wanders from the breath, as it inevitably will, to thoughts or feelings or memories or plans, we set that aside and come back to the breath over and over and over again. And that's the meditation. Thank you. And now, to end our meditation, as always, we do a brief dedication. We acknowledge that we've done something positive, something a little bit out of the ordinary. We've sat and worked with our mind, developed a little bit more concentration than we had when we came in here. And we think to ourselves, may that positive energy not be lost or wasted, but may it ripen in a way that benefits all living beings. Seems like we have some serious meditators in here. Probably could have gone for another 10 minutes, right? Any questions or comments about the posture or that meditation practice or meditation in general? Okay. So we'll continue with our discussion of karma. Karma is a Sanskrit term. What does it mean? Action, okay? It's not some... Yeah, it's action. It's an action of what? Body, speech, or mind, okay? Everything we do, everything we say, everything we think is an action that makes an imprint on our mind. And these imprints determine our future experience. So I want you to get the idea, think of karma as a psychological event. It's not something that's happening out there, this mystical force that's floating through the universe and forcing people to kill each other and things. I think of it as psychological, that everything we do, everything we say, everything we think is determining the kind of mind that we have. Okay? And as we study Buddhism, we begin to realize that it's primarily our mind that determines our experience. Okay? Everything that happens to us at some level is the result of our mind. So if our actions of body, speech, and mind are all generous, loving, kind, we will have a mind that is forced, we can even say, that has no choice but to experience happiness in the future. It's not that it'll just happen randomly, but we will be forced by our karma to experience happiness. If our actions of body, speech, and mind are motivated by greed, anger, attachment, impatience, we create a mind that will be forced to experience suffering in the future. That will have no choice. That is forced by karma to experience suffering. Everything we experience is the result of our karma, of the results of our past actions of body, speech, and mind. The fact that we're at Kadampa Center tonight for each of us is the result of some karmic imprints that we put on our mind stream in the past. And they are, as is said, they are ripening now. Okay, the had certain experiences today is a result of past karma. The fact that we had certain unpleasant experiences, irritating experiences, that's the result of imprints, karmic seeds, planted on our mind stream in the past that have ripened today. Okay? So it's actions of body, speech, and mind. And this is not something that the Buddha invented. It's not the idea of karma is not unique to Buddhism. I think what the Buddha did, he was describing what he saw. And he said karma is the most profound nature of reality, or one of the most profound natures of reality. It's just like gravity. It's impersonal. It just is the way things are. Okay? So that's what he's talking about when he's calling. He was just describing what he saw. Okay, so he described it in quite a lot of detail, and it said that karma is actually in many ways the most difficult topic in all of Buddhism, but we're going to talk about it in a pretty simple way in this class. And what I wanted to start with tonight, the main topic we'll be talking tonight, is what's referred to the four laws of karma, or four aspects of karma. So if you don't remember anything from this course, remember what karma is and remember the four laws of karma. And then you'll get an A+ on the exam, if there is an exam. But I don't think your karma is going to create an exam. I think you have I don't think you have exam karma in this course, okay? There are four laws of karma. The first one is that karma, I mean, if you're new to Tibetan Buddhism, you'll find out very quickly, there are lots and lots of lists. Four of this, 10 of that, 3 of that, and you get them all confused in this. Are we talking about the 3 principal aspects of the path, or the 3 higher trainings, or the 3 objects of refuge? You know, but they love to make lists of things for some reason. So if you're a numbers person, you're in the right place. Karma is definite. Okay, that's the first one. That's all. And what does that mean? That means that positive actions always, without exception, definitely lead to happiness. Negative actions always, invariably, definitely lead to suffering. Okay, so that brings up a lot of questions. What am I talking about? What are positive actions? Anybody want to take a stab at that? How do we determine if an action is positive or negative? What's the most important thing? Our intention or our motivation. Okay? So what are positive actions? Yeah, positive actions are defined kind of a strange way. It's said to be actions motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance. I don't know why, I'm not quite sure why they define them in those negative terms instead of the positive, but they're defined as actions motivated by non-attachment. Attachment means clinging, grasping. Non-hatred, the wish to harm others, either physically or mentally. Or non-ignorance, which means a misperception of reality. Okay? Actions motivated by those three characteristics lead to happiness. For whom? Whose happiness? Who do they make happy if I do an action motivated by non-attachment? If I generously give something to somebody, is that guaranteed to make them happy? Is that definite? No. It is guaranteed that at some point in the future, I will experience happiness as a result of that. It's definite for the person who's doing the action. Okay, and it certainly doesn't seem like that all the time. I mean, we can do something incredibly generous for someone and they can spit in our face. And that's certainly not a happy experience, okay? But the Buddha is saying, in terms of karma, the fact that they spit in our face is not the result of us giving them something, okay? At some point in the future, maybe even in future lives, if we believe that, I will have some experience of happiness related to that act of non-attachment or generosity. So we like to make a lot of false connections. We like to say, oh, I did this, so that happened back to me. And usually, most of the time, we're wrong, okay? But sometimes it's a useful way to think, anyway. If you're kind to someone else, maybe they'll be kind to you. But you can't count on it. But you can count on that your actions of kindness will lead to happiness in the future. No exception, okay? Similarly, negative actions. So how would we define negative actions here? Yeah, actions motivated by attachment, by clinging. Actions motivated by hatred. Actions motivated by ignorance will inevitably cause me to suffer in the future. Maybe not right away, but at some point. Okay? You know, there's no getting around it. There's no doing it in the middle of the night in the dark and thinking karma's not going to happen. It will happen. And we're talking about every action of body, every action of speech, every action of mind. Everything we think is making a karmic imprint on our mind stream. Okay? And they're there until, and we'll talk about this later, until they ripen. Okay. No exceptions to this. So that's kind of tough. I mean, to figure out our motivations. Our motivations are so mixed most of the time. And that's a consequence of being a human being. You know, we do something out of generosity, but there's a little bit of attachment or a little bit of I want something back. Our motivations are always mixed. So don't beat yourself up about that. Accept that as being a human being. And the Buddha said, okay, I understand it's difficult. So to help you out, I'm going to tell you about the ten negative actions. So now, this is not part of the law, but comes in appropriately. So now we get another list. This is the 10 negative actions. So I'm going to put that in here. And people immediately say it sounds like the 10 commandments, the thou shalt nots. And it's not like that. The Buddha's saying, if you want to do these things, go ahead, have at it. But they will, I'm just saying, they will inevitably cause you to suffer in the future. If you like to suffer, you're perfectly okay to do these. Don't avoid them because I'm telling you to avoid them. Avoid them if you don't want to suffer. Okay? So the Buddha said there are ten actions that, you know, if we can't get clear what our motivation is or what we're thinking, at least this is an easy way to avoid these actions. There are three of body. There are four of speech. And three of mind. I think most people are familiar with them. The three of body are killing, pretty straightforward. Stealing, okay. Taking something that's not freely given. Sexual misconduct. And there are, everybody wants to know right off the bat, wait, what's that mean? And there are lots of definitions, and some of them are quite graphic about how many times in what hole, during what phase of the moon and things like that. I mean, it really, it's in the teachings. It gets quite, yeah. But generally, the simplest way to do it is not to have sexual relations with someone else's partner or in a way that causes someone else pain. Okay? So that's pretty straightforward. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. Four of speech, and they are lying. No, there's one before that. Divisive speech. Okay. What's the next one? Somebody already said it. Harsh speech. And then idle gossip. Yeah. Or frivolous. Okay. Lying is pretty straightforward. Divisive speech is speech that divides, separates people, that creates a rift between people, either between friends or makes the rift wider between enemies. And it's said to be most worth a spiritual community. Harsh speech is criticizing harshly. Idle gossip doesn't mean you can't just sit around and talk, but it means wasting your entire human life, you know, following the adventures of the Kardashians or something like that. And, you know, talking about it at work the next day. Okay? So those are the ones. And the three negative acts of mind are... Yeah, craving, covetousness. There are lots of ways these are. Hatred. And one we've already mentioned, ignorance. Yeah. Okay, these are the things we talked about earlier. Covetousness, craving something, wanting something. Hatred, wanting to push something or somebody away or to harm them. And ignorance is based on not seeing reality. And this is, you know, really tough for us because we don't see reality. So most of what we do is out of ignorance, if we're willing to be honest with you. It means actions done out of not seeing things the way they are. Okay, in the first category, the worst, killing is the worst, and they get less severe as you go down. In speech, lying is the worst. They get less severe as you go down. And then for some reason in mind, they go in the opposite direction. Covetousness is the least heavy karmically, ignorance being the most heavy, the heaviest. So Buddha is saying, if you can't sit and analyze your motivation about your actions, at least you can develop the habit. You know, just really, and it is develop the habit of avoiding these actions. Okay? The ones of body are, for most of us, the easiest ones to avoid. Okay? The ones of speech are a lot harder. A lot harder. And the ones of mind, for most of us, are just, we can't even think about, you know, controlling our mind. But at least we can develop some awareness. First, start with our body. Then proceed with our mind, speech, and then with our mind. Or as Venerable Rabina always says, for those of us, zip your lips and keep your hands to yourself. If that's all you can do, that's going to help you avoid a lot of negative actions. Zip your lips and keep your hands to yourself. And that's a good place to start. Okay, then we can start working on the mind. Again, the Buddha is saying, there's nothing holy or spiritual about this. He's just saying, be aware of the consequences of your actions. If you do these, you will suffer. If you don't want to suffer, as much as you can, avoid these. But, you know, just to give you a little caveat, you know, killing can be done with a compassionate motivation. It would be impossible for us to do, but there are stories of the Buddha before he reached enlightenment was quite spiritually developed when he killed someone because he knew that person was going to kill hundreds of other people and get all this horrible karma. So he compassionately killed that person and took that negative karma to save that person from much worse karma. But most of us aren't at that stage of spiritual development. So it's better just to, as much as we can, avoid the actions. Okay? Any questions or comments? Let's do it into the mic for all those fans around the world who are listening to us.
So it seems like the hardest one to avoid would mostly be ignorance.
Yeah.
Just because it seems like, I mean, how would I know whether or not I'm even acting out of ignorance?
We're so ignorant we don't even know. I mean,
right.
We are living in a sea of ignorance.
So, like, how do you avoid that?
We can't, okay? That's the nature of being a human being, okay? But we can start to develop some wisdom, which means an understanding of reality, and with the faith that in the future we will get to that point. But unless, you know, some of y'all may be much farther along the path. But for most of us, trying to say, "Oh, I'm not going to do anything motivated by ignorance," is a fool's task. We just can't do it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Okay. So, everybody got that? I'm going to erase that and go back to our, drop the 10 and go back to our 4. Our 10 made up of 3, 4, and 3. Yeah. Okay. Okay, karma is definite, and we listed, the Buddha gave us some examples of negative actions to avoid to make it a little bit simpler. Again, he didn't make that up. He was just describing what he saw. Okay, second one. Karma expands. Which means a karmic seed planted on our mind stream by what seems a very insignificant action, say of speech, just a couple harsh words. The longer that karmic seed stays on our mind stream before it ripens, as it said, the more powerful it becomes. Okay, if it ripens quickly, it's not too strong, but if it ripens, say, over 10,000 countless lifetimes, it becomes very powerful, very heavy. Similarly, a very small positive action, a very, you know, just putting a dollar in a beggar's cup, over time can ripen and have enormous consequences. I mean, we see things like that in this lifetime where very seemingly insignificant actions or things that we say can cause a real rift in a friendship that may not, it expands and causes problems, or where small actions come back to us. This is all karmic seeds get more powerful over time. Now, why certain ones ripen at certain times is a whole other topic, and I'm not really going to go in. We may talk about that in one of the future classes. We want to, you know, the natural question to ask is, okay, so why do some stay on my mind stream for many lifetimes before they ripen, and others ripen quite quickly? It's said that some karmic seeds, strong ones, can ripen in the same lifetime, but not as many as we like to think. Most of them are over at least one or two lifetimes. But it's good to think that they're going to ripen in this lifetime. That's a very positive way to think, even if it may not be true. But why they ripen at certain times is dependent on something we refer to as cooperative conditions. We can do certain things that cause positive karma to ripen if we want to, or we can even cause negative karma to ripen if we want to get rid of it, if we want to experience it before it becomes stronger. And that's why you see these Tibetan lamas, they get a headache and they start rejoicing, say, oh, isn't that great? If that karma hadn't was in the next lifetime, it would be a brain tumor or something. I don't know, but you hear them talking that way. Okay? Any questions or comments? Yeah, Rod.
So you were talking about how, you know, we make these connections.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Say I went out and I stole something, and I'm immediately caught and arrested and punished for it.
Yeah.
It looks like.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the I can't say for sure until I see reality, but more than likely, that's probably not the cause of your being arrested in a karmic sense. Okay, in a conventional sense, it is. An example that that I've heard one of the teachers give is that we think the cause of making a fortune on the stock market is picking the right stocks, right? Actually, the cause of making a fortune on the stock market is having been generous in the past, is having given things to other people in the past. It looks like there's a direct cause and effect. I picked this stock, I made a fortune. According to the Buddhist point of view, no, you made the fortune because you gave something to somebody at something in the past. I mean, this is where karma gets really, I can't explain it, but that's, I'm just giving you the party line. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
I hope I can say this accurately. So you're saying that the good things that are happening to me now are because of things that have been in the past lives?
More than likely, okay. Probably a lot of it, okay. None of it's random, according to the Buddhist point of view. And it's not necessarily because of good things you've done in this life, but most of it is probably, you know, I'm really hedging it there, is probably due to past actions in previous lifetimes, if you accept that. Okay? Three. Third law, and this kind of gets to what you're just mentioning. You can't... experience the result without having created the cause. Now, it sounds kind of wordy, so what does that mean? There's no such thing as a result without a cause. There's nothing that happens randomly. Everything we're experiencing now, everything from the biggest things, you know, to having a wonderful partner, having great children, to having a hangnail this morning, to being in this room and seeing red cushions, okay? Everything is the result of causes we've created in the past. There is nothing in our experience that we did not create the cause for. Everything wonderful that happens to us, everything unhappy that happens to us, we created the cause for it, okay? Similarly, we will not experience anything in the future that we don't create the causes for. There will be no results that we don't create the causes for. We won't just luck out and win life's lottery. If we want to be happy in the future, we have to create the causes for that. If we want to avoid unhappiness, we have to avoid creating the causes for unhappiness. Everything we experience from the Buddhist point of view, we're talking about multiple lifetimes, but I think it's useful to think about it in this lifetime. Everything we want to experience in the future, we have to create the causes for. We won't just get lucky. We won't just win the lottery. So whatever we want to experience in the future, we have to create the causes for that. Whatever we're experiencing now, we created the causes for it sometime in the past. Nothing is random. Okay, it is everything is the result of our karma. I mean, what we're experiencing right now, I mean, at least for me, and I'm assuming this is for the rest of you, I do not have a choice to be in this room and experience purple cushions on the floor. I do not have that karma for some reason. At some reason, I created the at some point in the past, I created the karma to be in this room and experience red cushions. I don't have a choice. I am being controlled by that past karma. Now, if for some reason, experiencing purple cushions in here was really important to me, I'd have to create the causes for it. That's a pretty trivial example. But if I want to meet kind people, people who are generous, if I want to be happy, I have to create the causes for that. If I'm unhappy now, I have to accept that that is the result of my past actions. It's not the result of people out there who do things to me. They're the result of my karma also. Okay? So we have a question back here.
Can someone else influence your karma?
That is a good question. And I am not really qualified to answer that because I've heard various interpretations of that. I've heard both sides of that, yeah, so I don't know. I tend to think of it as probably not. No, the Buddha killed the guy. He knew the guy, he could see the future, okay? He saw that guy was going to kill, okay? So he killed him first. But he was not changing that man. I mean, he was changing his karma in a way. Yeah, so I see. Yeah, it's tricky. And then they talk about collective karma, which I don't think means our karma goes into this big pool. I think it means the fact that we're all here in this room together means we have some sort of similar karma. That's why we're here together. So we have some sort of, and we have some sort of karmic connection with each other in the past. But in terms of insight, where this, you know, I think the Buddha, if he could have, he would have changed all our karma so we don't suffer, right? So that's kind of the way I look at it. You know, he's not, he didn't have that ability. He certainly would if he could, because he's all compassionate. But he hasn't taken away everybody's negative karma and made them Buddhas also. But you'll hear different answers from that. That's a good question. As we always say when we're leading one of these, that's a question for a Geshe. Any other comments or questions? Yeah, over here, Mike. Here, open. Oh, that's just your karma, Joanna. Don't be such a victim.
What did you do in the past life?
Yeah, to create the causes to get old.
I think I can understand how you can have a... If you do something in the past, especially like over and over again, you can have like a propensity for something.
Yeah,
in the
future, we'll talk about that next week. Yeah.
Like an aura of something or a tendency towards something. You know,
doing an action creates not only the result, the experience of the result, but it creates the tendency to do that action again. Yeah.
But I have a problem with the details. Like, you know, if I do something in my past life and we have a family dinner together that we really enjoy the family, I don't see that detailed. I could see where if you want to be a good person and you want to share that with your children and so you have family dinners, that's like a manifestation of your attitude or your long, you know what I'm saying, more of a general imprint than the actual tit-for-tat kind of thing.
Think about it, general imprints. Don't think about it as tit-for-tat. That makes it too mechanistic, I think. Yeah.
Well, you're
it's what
about,
kind
like,
of mind
nails and everything. I didn't know how specific it like.
Yeah. That was a kind of a trivial example, but I think it's more what kind of mind are you creating?
Okay.
So I mean, I think we all know people who've, you know, our saintly grandmothers or some people go through life and do not see an enemy. They just do not see enemies anywhere. And that's the result of having created a mind full of so many positive imprints that enemy does not arise in their consciousness.
Another thing, my wife and I have even talked about, sometimes we've seen people in our own experience that are good people, at like a middle age, and it seems to exaggerate as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
They're nice people, they seem to be even nicer, like the great
ones. Uh-huh.
If they're kind of crotchety, they're even worse when they get older.
Exactly, when some of the inhibitions disappear. Yeah.
And Venerable Robina saying that if you know that, say, eating chocolate is going to cause acne,
mm-hmm.
and you get a pimple, you don't worry about, like, which M&M did that, that specific.
Yeah.
You know, you just know in general that previous action resulted in.
Yeah, the fact that I have a pimple means I was eating chocolate, yeah. Mm-hmm. And what this leads to, I think, is a mind state, this gets back a little bit, of taking complete responsibility and not being a victim about anything, no matter how awful it is. Which doesn't mean, you know, taking responsibility is not to say to blame, but saying, I am not a victim in this situation. You know, I have created this situation. If I don't like it, I need to avoid creating this situation again in the future. Okay, let's see. Over here, and then we'll go over there.
Would you mind expounding a little bit on the difference between collective consciousness and universal consciousness?
Why are you asking that question right now? Yeah.
It came up, this collective consciousness, this collective karma.
Yeah.
And one day, fairly recently, Geshe-la kind of mentioned something like that.
Yeah.
You know, he said that there was no universal consciousness, but there's a collective consciousness. So that's not a quick question, is it?
I can't answer it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really a question for a Geshe, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't hear. Oh, okay, yeah. I didn't. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, but I cannot answer that. Let's see, I had a couple over here.
Well, this I'm sure came up before, but if we're saying things in past lives lead to everything that happens to us now, it's so easy to say, well, it's not my, to not take responsibility. It's not my fault. It's something my former life did generations ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point, and that's why this point in the Lama Rim is taught after developing some sense of previous lifetimes, okay, consciousness. I think there's a certain amount of faith there. You have to believe that I have some connection to my past lives, I have some connection to my future lives, I don't remember them, it wasn't me, but there is some connection, yeah. Okay, it's a good point, and I can't answer that really well, okay? But you may want to think about karma as it works in this lifetime, okay? Some of it does work in this lifetime. You can forget about past and future lives and think about how it would work in this lifetime. Yeah, give him the mic back, please. Yeah.
Well, throughout all these modules, I'm shifting what I believe versus what the party line is.
Uh-huh.
But it occurred to me that even if I don't believe in past lives, I do believe in genetics.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that the shape of my nose, the color of my eyes, my personality, to some extent, I believe in nature and nurture, to some extent is due to generations of my past parents, grandparents, and so on.
Yeah.
And so that's easy for me to believe.
Yeah. And even if we don't believe in past or future lives, maybe living this life with a belief in karma would make us happier in this life, possibly. You know, taking responsibility for all our actions and trying to avoid the negative ones. Who created the karma for more rain tonight? Yeah, everybody who's experiencing that. Okay, the last law of karma is karma is not lost. Okay. Some of these karmic seeds just don't happen to fall off our mind stream, or we can't pick up the rug and scoot a few under there. They are all going to stay there. Every action of body, speech, and mind creates a karmic imprint that stays on our mind stream until it ripens, until we experience its results. For all of them, okay? Now, there are two exceptions for this. One is it said we can purify negative karma. This is what we refer to when we talk about purification practice. And these are various practices the Buddha gave us, and we'll get into these later, that can lessen the strength of negative karmic seeds on our mind stream. Okay. It said when we have a direct experience of emptiness, when we see things as they really are, we can actually remove negative karmic seeds completely from our mind stream. We can purify them completely. Most of us are not there, but we can lessen them. And you talk to the serious practitioners and the great teachers, and they emphasize over and over and over again that purification practice is so important. And if you don't seem to be making any progress or you're hung up, they'll generally going to tell you you need to do some purification practice. There's probably a lot of ignorance type seeds on your mind stream that you're not even aware of that you need to purify, do the lessen their impact. And purification practice can be, as Geshe-la says, Geshe-la says lots of times, you have to get up where you fell down. So if you spoke harshly to someone, the way to purify that is not to go sit in your meditation room and say some mantras. The thing is to go to them and apologize. So it can be something as simple as that. Don't get too woo-woo about it. But it can be involved in saying mantras, doing certain visualizations. There's a specific practice called Vajrasattva that we'll get to in the next weeks, and we'll go through that practice. Okay, so negative karmic seeds can be purified, which means lessened and ultimately removed. So that's good news. The bad news is that positive karmic seeds can be destroyed. How do we destroy positive karma? Anger, yeah. Okay. Anger, in addition to being creating negative karma, has the quality of, it said it burns up good karma. Because when you are consumed by anger, there's just no room for anything else in your mind. It is just so pervasive that it destroys good karma and causes you to create more bad karma. So anger is a good one to avoid. Okay, destroys positive karma. So those are kind of the two exceptions or mitigating factors if karma is not lost. Okay, so just to review, karma is definite. Positive actions always lead to happiness for the person who does them. Negative actions always lead to suffering. And that's kind of vague, so if we want to think of actions to avoid, we avoid killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, frivolous speech, covetousness, hatred, or ill will, that's sometimes called ill will, and ignorance. Okay? Karma expands over time. We can't experience the result without having created the cause. Everything now created the cause for in the past. Everything we want to experience in the future, it won't happen unless we create the cause for it. And then karma is not lost, with the caveats that purification practice can weaken or at some point even eliminate negative karma from our mind stream, and anger can destroy positive karma. So those are the four laws or four rules or four qualities of karma. Questions or comments? Okay, back here. Yeah.
I'm really struggling with this purification thing,
yeah.
And I always have. It always just rubs me the wrong way. So,
why does it rub you the wrong way?
Because, I mean, I'm taking it really far, but if I kill someone and then mm-hmm. I say some mantras, am I good? Like, that just doesn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. How does that help?
Well, we're going to do a whole class on purification. That's a subject in this module. We'll do a whole night talking about purification.
All right, thanks.
Okay, but it seems, yeah, I'm going to go out and kill and steal and sexual misconduct myself, and then I'm going to come back and say some mantras. I hear, yeah, it's, yeah. Well, it's very similar psychologically, but we need to think about it as a psychological process. How are we removing these negative imprints? But we'll talk about that. That's a good comment. Yeah. Was it your hand?
Definitely not.
Okay, definitely not. Okay, any other comments?
Just like self-defense or white anger, somebody's
going to
shoot you, so you kill them.
Yeah. That's where your motivation is going to be mixed, okay? If you want to, you know, someone is, you know, if you... Or the example it's given is stealing a loaf of bread to feed your starving children, okay? Certainly you're motivated by compassion, Okay, but it said at the moment that you pick up that loaf of bread, there is a negative mind state going on because you are taking something that's not yours. So it's mixed. Okay. And that's part of the problem with being a human being. Our motivations most of the time, if we're honest, are mixed. So it's a combination of both, yeah. But that's the kind of thing, if you're in that situation, you just felt like you had to do it, then you may be doing some purification practice afterwards because your motivation was primarily compassionate. But there is some negative karma created by that, definitely. I mean, and there can be negative and positive karma created by our mixed motivations. Yeah.
But you're taking responsibility for that choice.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And in a way, the fact that you're willing to take on negative karma to feed your children is even more compassionate in some ways, you could say. So it's very, very mixed lots of times. Okay. Let's do another brief meditation. Okay, wiggle around. And check your posture, starting at the top and moving down. Quickly identify any sources of tension that may be there. Three deep breaths from the abdomen. And now set your motivation. And now a couple minutes of mind on the breath meditation, concentration, to get our mind to that really focused, calm state, very concentrated. We're not blanking out, we're not spacing out, we're very concentrated and focused. And now, keeping our mind in this clear, concentrated state, we're just going to do a very simple review meditation, fixing the points in our mind, thinking about what they mean precisely so that we're really clear. Not so much whether I believe it or don't believe it, that's not the point. We really just want to get clear on what the points are, the four laws of karma. The first is that karma is definite. Positive actions, those motivated by positive mind states, always lead to happiness. Negative actions, those motivated by negative mind states, always lead to suffering. No variability. It's definite. So just think about what that means and get very clear on that in your mind for the next minute. The second law of karma is that karma expands over time. Very small actions of body, speech, and mind can have very great results in the future. Both negative actions and positive actions expand over time. The third law of karma is that there are no results without causes. Everything that I am experiencing in this lifetime is a result of previous karmic actions. Everything, from the most trivial to the most significant events in my life, everything is the result of previous actions. And similarly, everything that I will experience in the future will be determined by what I am now doing with my body, speech, and mind. I will not experience anything that I have not created the cause for. And the fourth law of karma is that karmic imprints are not lost. Every imprint made by body, speech, and mind will ripen in the future in a way that I experience it. They are not lost. with the caveats that negative karmic imprints can be purified. We can lessen their strength. And anger can destroy positive karmic imprints. And you can end your meditation by doing a brief dedication. Okay, Miss Joanna is going to pass out the homework.
We already passed it.
Okay, it's pretty self-explanatory. Next week we're going to talk about how we experience the results of our how we experience the results of our karma, the different ways, and we're going to talk about some of the factors that determine how strong these various karmic seeds are. And then after that, we'll actually get into purification. So, stay dry, drive carefully, and see everyone next week. Thank you.